Welcome to Career Crossroads, the podcast about career pivots and the people who make them. I'm your host, Jonathan Colleton, and if you're struggling with a career decision or work with people who need help making career decisions, I am glad you are here. Today, we've got a full-length Career Crossroads interview with Dan Shand, the Millionaire's Mentalist. As his stage name hints at, Dan is a magician who often performs for very wealthy clientele, sometimes even being flown on private jets to secret locations to perform for them. So when I found out that Dan's first job out of college was working at PayPal, I knew there must be a story there. In fact, Dan was working at PayPal so early in the history of the company that he is part of a group known as the PayPal Mafia, and they are called such because many of those employees went on to found companies like SpaceX and YouTube and Yelp and LinkedIn. But those employees are all software engineers and investors, so their path is less surprising. Dan, however, became a magician, and I think that is surprising. How did he go from PayPal to magician? This episode starts a little bit differently. The first thing you're going to hear will be Dan's response to me saying that I wanted to establish the journey that he took to get where he is today. All you need to know from the content before that is that Dan grew up in San Francisco and was not a big fan of school. If you want to hear where his journey took him, keep listening.
It's really interesting that you said we're going on a journey, because I wanted to block out some of my years because there are a lot of things I wish I did that I didn't do in high school, a little bit of regret, and you know, just wishing that you could relive certain parts of your life sometimes. Just so that's why I sometimes gloss over those high school years, because I got one job one time, I think it was really early on. And I literally quit, I think, after the first or second day. It was really that bad. I was filing stuff at a hospital. And I was like, I cannot do this, 8 hours a day. It was so bad. And I worked as an assistant recreation person at this park. I think it's called Richmond Playground in San Francisco, a couple blocks from my house. And I was from fourth grade to eighth grade, I was picked on. You know, I had funny looking ears, and I still do. People called me monkey. And during that time, I started working out. And by the time I got to high school, I was the buffest guy there, but I was still socially awkward. Like, I didn't know a lot of things because my parents were divorced. And my mom was a nurse, and they were immigrants. And they were middle-class people, but my dad, they split up very early. And that's you wish that things were different.
Interesting. Okay. So as a buff guy, you told me before you were a student athlete. So tell me about that. Was athletics something that you did out of enjoyment, or you did to stay in shape? Did you ever see that as a potential career path?
I'm a addictive type of guy. When I see something, do or eat something, sometimes I get addicted. So I would have these weights, and they were the only weights I had, but they were pretty light. And I would just do it for hours on end. I would stand in front of the TV, and I would be addicted to TV and addicted to working out. So I would just work out, and people thought I was on steroids.
Really?
But I was just like, literally, I would just do bicep curls, and then I would do military presses and all the other things. But I would just watch TV, and when the TV was on, I was exercising, and I would watch way too much TV for a kid.
Wow. Well, at least if you were watching TV, you were doing something else productive at the same time, not just sitting on the couch. And obviously it paid off because you were an athlete. So all that working out got you somewhere. I'm sure you've got to think back on some of those days, and whether or not you've kept up that workout routine now, I'm sure you were happy. I'm sure you're happy that you were doing that back then.
Absolutely.
All right. So student athlete, what other types of things were you interested in high school? From an academic standpoint, what did you excel at?
I excelled at watching TV. I really did not know what I would like to do. I kind of blocked things out. Like, pole vaulting, I was the best in my school because no one could do it. And I was pretty buff, but I had no real good coaching. And it's important to get coaching in life. The guy who was running our track and field team didn't have a pole vault coach. He didn't know how to do anything. So literally, he kind of just didn't know what he was doing when he was teaching me. So I wasn't very good because of the coaching. But I started realizing the importance of coaching more and more later on, especially when I started teaching my son doing what he's doing.
Okay. All right. So, and I know we're going to get into that because what you're doing now has become more of a family business. So I'm excited to hear more about that. But when it comes to you, when you were your son's age, what did you think you might be doing in the future? You know, you were doing some athletics, but you didn't have that coaching. So obviously it wasn't something that was a path you really saw yourself pursuing. What did you think you might do when you graduated high school?
I didn't know, but people would tell me, like, people would be like, optometry is good. My mom was like, oh, you should be an optometrist or accountant, because we would just read the USA World News reports. And that was like, this was going to trend in 10 years and all that stuff. It was all off. Like, if I listened to it, I would have been in a dead end career. And like, I know my accountant, he hates what he's doing. I know like someone who's an optometrist and he hates it. So I'm so glad that I didn't give in to that pressure of trying to live up to someone else's expectation, because you can regret that a long time, or you can just corner yourself in something. So I say to people, try as many different things as possible, but give it your all when you're in that spot. And if you know you're in the wrong lane, exit. I did the Coast Guards as well, a lot later as a reservist. But that was when I got burnt out. But I love jumping around, and I'm a little bit ADD sometimes. I can be, at least.
Okay. All right. Well, don't worry. I'm here to keep you on track for today, at least, anyway. After this interview, sorry, somebody else can help you. But for now, I'm here. All right. So you looked at these lists of careers that might be good careers to have, but none of them were of interest to you. But at the end of the day, when you graduate high school, you have to make a decision. And that decision is either to just go get a job in the workforce or to go get post-secondary education. What was the choice that you made?
Okay, I applied to three schools: UC Berkeley, Irvine, and Riverside. On hindsight, I didn't know anything and I didn't do any research. And the first day I stepped on the campus of Riverside was my first day there. I did not tour the school like normal people do.
Yeah.
And I didn't know the reputation. The only reason why I went to Riverside was my cousin, who was studying to be a doctor, went there. And that program had like an accelerated guarantee to UCLA. If you did a certain, if you did something well, you would automatically get into UCLA or something like that. So I was clueless, but because he went there, I was like, okay, I'll follow along. And I was just following along the bandwagon. And I did not know Irvine was a party school. I did not know Riverside was in the desert. If I knew anything on hindsight, I probably would have gone to Irvine.
You would have chosen that party school atmosphere, but instead you're reliant on, you said, one of your cousins. So you had someone whose path you weren't maybe trying to emulate, but it was the only path that you saw available where you knew someone who was doing it and who could give you advice on that, perhaps. Is that why you really chose it? Just because it was the one thing you knew?
He didn't give me advice, but he did give me some rides because he had a car, and I did not have a car until the last year of college.
Okay.
So I was bumming rides off people in, you know, social clubs. And it was just kind of like a safety net. If I needed anything, my mom said something like, oh, if you need anything, if you need to go to the supermarket, he can go with you,
yeah,
you know, until you make friends.
And I get that.
That was just kind of like, I didn't have a lot of close friends in high school. So college kind of was the same thing, and I didn't really care to.
Okay, so I get that. I mean, I went to a university with a bunch of my cousins. We all went to the same school, so I ended up having other family there the entire time I was there. One of my cousins was in fifth year when I was in first, another was my age, and then I was the fifth year when another one was in first, and two others went at various points. So I get it. Family goes somewhere. It becomes where you go to for all those types of reasons. Now, when you apply to these schools, you have to say that you want to go for a specific program, right? You mentioned that your cousin was looking at this sort of fast track to medicine or to pre-med type of a program. Is that what it was?
Yeah. And the funny thing is, I know I didn't do well in chemistry in high school, or I had no interest in it, nor did I have any interest in biology. because I know I didn't do well in that either, but I somehow checked off the box that I was going in for biochem.
Biochem. So you picked biochem. And how did you get in if you didn't do well in those classes in high school?
It's Riverside, man. It's Riverside.
Well, I'm not from there. I don't know anything about Riverside. I'm not even sure I've ever heard of it before. So I guess, okay, it sounds like Riverside is not the most academically prestigious institution. Would that be correct?
They have lots of oranges out there, and they're famous for a couple of different programs now, supposedly. But when I was there, I didn't even, it wasn't even on my radar.
Right.
That's just where it falls. It's a UC, so it's like UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, Irvine. So it's supposedly higher up in the States, I guess, on some people's ranking, but it is a University of California, and it's located in Riverside, so UCR. Gotcha. And it's the coolest things about Riverside was I learned how to lifeguard, and I got my scuba certification, my NAWI certificate for scuba diving.
Okay, so you did get something very valuable, it sounds like. If you're bringing those up in a podcast about your career, you bring up lifeguarding, you bring up scuba. Were those things that interested you more so than the classes that you were taking?
Yeah, that and pool. Shooting pool was really cool. I love that, but there was no jobs to shoot pool. So after the first year or the second year, I don't remember. I think it was the first year. I got my certificate for lifeguarding, and they asked me for a referral for a job, or someone suggested that. And it was Santa Monica YMCA Camp Big Bear. And the guy interviews me, asks, will you be willing to teach sailing? And I'm like, I don't know how to sail. And he said, if I taught you, would you be willing to do it? And I said, yeah, of course. Like, are you going to teach me? And he's like, yes, show up a week early or show up a few days early. And he literally taught me how to sail in less than a week and get to a proficiency I could teach it.
Wow.
And the guy was the coolest guy. His name was Richie. It was a short, buff, old guy. He was really great sailing teacher. And there I taught canoeing, motorboating, sailing. And that was just with a lifeguard degree. And year after that, I worked at another summer camp. And then the year after that, I worked at another camp. And I kept on working at summer camps in Huntington Lake, in Catalina, and even small like day camps as well.
Were those things you did just because you needed a job and you had to make money? Or it sounds like you obviously enjoyed it if you went back to a variety of different camps. But was it something where you thought, you know, I could see myself doing something like this professionally afterwards?
I kind of could see that. Like, that was like the dream. And I told my mom, hey, I want to be a lifeguard at this camp. And she totally said no. The first thing I was like, what? I want to do this. I really want to do this. So I honored her wishes because she said, you'll never be able to have a family, which I think she'd be pretty right about that. I mean, lifeguards don't get paid a lot. Even when I look at the applications now, it's just like a passing summer job, but it's a cool job to me. And, you know, I'm really glad that I listened to her, but at that time I cried. I was like, that was my goal. That was my goal in life, was to be a beach bum.
To be a beach bum. Yeah. So, I mean, you've been pretty clear on this so far, but if I can kind of summarize, academics, not a major priority for you at this point in time. You were at a school, but you were not even in a program initially that you wanted to be in, or you didn't see yourself having a high level of success in. Is that accurate? That's what I'm hearing so far anyway.
Yeah. But I did, right after I got caught in for, you know, copying someone's biochemistry or chemistry thing, I ended up transferring to business administration, which was so interesting to me. Like, there was marketing books and there was business, and I got really interested in that. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I would win all these standardized testing awards for this business class. There was like all these schools would test for awards, and I just came out on top on that. And I was like, wow, business is my thing.
Okay. What was the first thing that tipped you off that you might be interested in that? Like, before you transferred into it, I'm sure there was a moment where you said, this could be interesting.
To be honest, no. It was like, if I wanted to stay in biochem, it was just me being lazy, to be honest. I got a C minus in one of the classes, and in order to continue on that class, I needed a C. So I ended up saying, if I transferred major, a C minus would be okay. But if you wanted to stay in this particular field, you got to retake it. And I'm like, I'm not going to spend another 6 months or another semester doing this class that I had no interest in and I wanted to coast. I was like, I knew I could have done better, but I was like, I'm not going to want to do this again. It's like Groundhog Day. So I was like, no, forget that. Let's just exit.
Okay. All right. So business admin, you transfer into that. You obviously were a lot more successful in that if you were getting these awards for this standardized testing. Did you ever have any jobs during university that were related to that, or was it just the camp jobs and your academics and, you know, what your future degree would be was very much separate from the jobs you were working during university?
Nope. Find your passion and the profits will follow.
Okay. Was that your attitude back then, or is that your attitude now?
It's now, but I think it was just in the back. I just never found the alliteration, but I think alliterations are hypnotic.
Okay, so now you know the words for the thing that you must have been thinking back then, which is why you did these summer jobs you enjoyed and didn't really focus on getting work that was related to the program. Would that be right?
Yeah, I think as young men, often we can have this vision in our head, but we can't articulate it. There's actually a word for that I just learned, that something that happens only in your head and it's not like spoken. And it's there's a really cool word for it, but I'll have to look it up.
You can't remember that word right now. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So as you're going through and you're starting to get closer to the end of that degree, you're going to have this degree in business administration. Were you beginning to put thought into what kind of work you might wanted to do with that degree once you graduated?
I really didn't know what I was doing still.
Still.
Yeah. Okay. And that's kind of like I did a job teaching after school for fourth grade at a Cornerstone Academy, which was in San Francisco. And I was just showing little kids magic tricks at the end of class. I would do some side hustle, like of once in a while street performing and doing this. And I would go to these magic lectures and they were just like, you pay 25 or 30 bucks and they would happen once a month. And they were live magic lectures. And I always say that if you can meet people who have been where you want to go, you can replicate a similar success. Listening to those stories will motivate you. If they can do it, I can do it too.
Mm-hmm.
That was my attitude.
That's great. That's my attitude. That's why I interview people on this show. So you were working doing magic, not actually doing something in business administration. Does that mean that this whole time you had just been working on your magic skills while you were in university?
Yeah, I would meet these guys, Robert and Mike Chang, who were brothers. And Robert already graduated, I think, but he would come back for the juggling club. Same with Mike. And I bugged them to let me borrow their VHS tapes, and they let me borrow it. And that was kind of like my side hobby or passion. When I wasn't doing work, I would be learning that. And that's a good indicator of what you should do, is what do you do in your spare time? What are you so passionate about that you could do without getting paid? Because in the beginning, when you start a business, it almost feels like you're not getting paid or you're doing so much extra work. But if it doesn't feel like it's extra work, that's the field that you should be in. Like, what are you doing when you're not getting paid? And if you're learning something, find a way to monetize that. And that's, to me, the starting points or the seeds. You see these things sprout up, but that's where I would encourage people to go.
Right. And so were you basically saying that to yourself at that time, that you had this interest in magic and you wanted it to be a career, so you really needed to work at it very hard?
No, it wasn't. I just wanted it as a hobby. Later on, I found out that I went to an event. I got 10 bucks as a tip for twisting balloons, and the magician was there, and he got 250 or 300 bucks. I was like, I could do what you're doing in a couple of years. Then I found out these other guys were making like 800 bucks to 1,200 bucks for a very short evening's worth of work. I was like, I can do that. And it took me like 10 years to get there. mm-hmm. to that point, but it was a fun journey, even though I felt like I was working very hard.
Mm-hmm. So you're what, 24, 22 to 23, 24 when you graduate, you're doing a little bit of magic work. You're clearly spending a lot of time doing things on the side, trying to learn new skills and get better at that. But at the same time, you have this degree in business administration. And from everything you've said so far, you have a mother who is very much trying to help target you in a specific direction. She's trying to get you settled in a career that will be a good future career. We talked about optometry and things like that before. You told her you want to be a lifeguard, and she says, that's not a career. Were you feeling any pressure from family or from friends or even from yourself to find a career that was within the field that you had studied to enter?
Like they would tell me stuff, but I'm pretty stubborn. I'm pretty independent and pretty brave. So the coolest thing was my mom didn't kick me out of the house once I came back
thing.
From college.
This must be a different, I don't know if it's a generational thing or a Canadian-American thing, but it is not common here anyway that the expectation is you get kicked out of the house when you're finished college. Now, part of that for sure is like the cost of housing these days, but you thought you were going to get kicked out and so it was cool that she didn't kick you out?
No, I just had friends like their parents pushed them out. They kind of expected them to stand their own 2 feet. My mom didn't expect a lot, you know, like she just had me at home, but that allowed me to travel, to go to conventions every year. And I had extra money and I didn't need to make a lot of money in the beginning because I had a runway, and every business needs enough speed to take off.
So she was, would you say, encouraging of your interest in magic and wanting to clearly turn that into a career?
Definitely not encouraging.
Definitely not.
She was surprised that people were paying me so much. They're like, but that's not consistent. That's not all the time, Dan. Like, I'd be making more than her. Like, I think, you know, I'd be making more than her per hour, but she'd be working 8-hour days and I'd only be working like weekends for the most part. And then maybe some schools and libraries. But, you know, hourly, I was doing really well, you know, but when you look at how much I'm investing, I was probably getting paid very little because of all the practice. Because magic requires a lot of practice, right?
All right. So you're living at home. You're clearly spending a lot of money, it sounds like, and time trying to get better at magic. But again, you've got this degree in business admin, and I know that you end up leveraging that degree because you ended up getting a job at PayPal. So how did that happen? Because it doesn't sound so far like you have any interest in doing anything related to that. You just have a piece of paper with business admin on it. And obviously from the classes you told me about and the testing you were doing, you were very good at that. But how do you end up working your way into that field of work?
So PayPal, I think probably had like a newspaper article asking for jobs when newspapers were still a thing. I'm pretty sure it was that. And I went in for an interview and for customer service, and they were giving away these referral bonuses. Like I think at that time it was either $5 or $10. And if you signed up a friend, you would get money and they would get money.
Signed up a friend for PayPal, like as a service?
Yeah.
Because this is early days of PayPal, right? What era are we talking about here?
We're talking about 1999, I think.
So pre-internet bubble burst.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was way early on. I joined PayPal before Elon Musk joined PayPal.
Okay, so explain to me exactly what you were doing for work, because what you were saying before, I think I have an impression of what that was and referrals and stuff, but explain to me what the actual job was.
So I got hired on as customer service, answering customer service calls. People would get their accounts locked or they'd have questions, and then we'd had a standard procedure to kind of escalate things. And there was a lot of fraud on that platform in the early days. But then shortly afterwards, I told everyone, hey, I've got a business degree. Can I get transferred? And they transferred me to finance, which I thought I was going to be doing mergers and acquisitions or something like that. But they had a lot of really experienced people with better soft skills. Keep in mind, I was really young and I didn't have a lot of soft skills back then. So they just shoved me into bank deposits. So people would verify their bank accounts by putting in 14 cents and a penny. And then they would put on the online portal stating, hey, I got this 14 cents and a penny. Some people would actually send us a check or give us change for that same amount. And that was their, it was like a gift to them. They didn't have to pay us back. But because we had millions of users at that time, there'd always be that quirky one or two that didn't follow instructions and didn't realize that that was their money. So I, by law, had to drive this money to Silicon Valley Bank and deposit it for them and credit their account. So I would make this spreadsheet. I would deposit the money into their account. And I'd usually be done by two or three in the day. And everyone else was coding and working really hard. And I was just like coasting, waiting for the clock to hit five and then leave and then come back. And the engineers at that time would work relentlessly. They were working 12 to 16 hour days or crazy stuff like that. They would be sleeping under their own desk. They had, I remember these crazy engineers would have a bed like under their table. Like they would be slipping out like, you know, enough space for an extra bed and they would just sleep there.
Okay. So you're using that degree finally, and you're in PayPal, you go from customer service, and it's easy enough. Well, I mean, you had the skills, obviously, but you can just ask for a transfer and show them a degree, and they said, like, sure, and transferred you over? Or did you have to go through a hiring process for that?
I don't know what they were doing. I don't think they knew what they were doing. And it was just happening so fast. It was just insane. Like, they were just hiring people. In fact, like, I started working with guys who eventually founded Yelp and LinkedIn and all these other famous companies. In fact, one of the guys I gave magic lessons to ended up becoming the ambassador to Sweden.
Huh.
And
he used to work with you at PayPal?
Yep. And, you know, I worked with Elon and Peter and all these other guys at PayPal. And, you know, I wish I took photos because, like, I don't have any photos from back then. And in order to verify this for Business Insider article, and they're like, oh, you have proof that you worked there? I was like, I lost my stock certificates. I lost this. My stock certificate actually was issued and it actually said x.com.
Because that's before the name change or after? Like, explain this to people who might not be aware, because I've done a little bit of cursory research, but I know, like, there was PayPal, x.com was Elon Musk's thing, and then they merged or something like that?
Yep. So he had more money, and we were burning money. So we had a burn rate of losing money. So we decided that if we were to join forces, we wouldn't have to compete against each other.
Gotcha.
So we can take on Visa and MasterCard, and they had crazy visions of, like, if we only took 1% of the tax revenue of the US and it was taken via PayPal, we would make X amount of dollars. And this was like the Kool-Aid that they were selling us. And it was just insane. And then we had t-shirts that said one world currency. And when Elon was there, it was just crazy because he loved X.com. So when X-Men movie came out, he bought the whole theater to let us watch that. And we got t-shirts that said X-Men. We got X-Men t-shirts that day. And the legend is Steve Jobs wanted that theater, but we placed a deposit before him and they had to say no to Steve Jobs. And that's when Steve Jobs was like someone and we were like no one. Like PayPal, we didn't even know if we were going to still be around because in those days, we couldn't talk about it, but we were losing a lot of money. Every day, like literally Russian mobsters and fraudsters were out there.
Yeah. Did you feel then like you actually had a long-term future at PayPal, given that it was this growing company and with the merger with X.com and with all this Kool-Aid that you were getting fed, did you feel like there was a long-term future for you?
No, I knew that they were going somewhere, but I knew I had a different path. I knew that they were going somewhere, but it could also be a Titanic because at this point in time, the growth and we had great publicity. They knew what they were doing. But at the same time, you're losing like $60,000 a day or $60,000 a month or something insane like that. And I'm like, oh, if we have 22 months of burn rate. If we continue at where we're at, we're going to run out of money in 22 months. And then it became like X months. And then we went through another round of financing so that then our shares got diluted. And then there's just so much complex math to it. I got 10,000 shares, which converted several times before the IPO and before eBay merged. But everything was happening so fast. And with valuations, it's just crazy. I'm in finance and I studied some of that and it's still I still need a refresher sometimes.
Right. So you were on the train, and the train was, you knew someone was in control, but you didn't really know what was going on, but you felt like at some point you were getting off the train.
Yeah, they were sending jobs to India in customer service. At the same time, there was a lot of redundancies, or there are certain things that I was doing that other people could do for me. So at that time, there was a rumored of layoffs, and I was like, yes, severance, you know.
You were hoping for that.
No, I saw people crying when they left the human resources. When I left, that was like a happy day for me. I really wanted to leave, but I couldn't leave because my mom wouldn't let me.
Okay, so your Although mom was very
influential. Although I wish I stayed there, because I did a calculation. If I stayed at PayPal, I would have been worth at least $5 million.
Because of your stocks?
Yeah.
If you didn't sell them already, though.
Yeah, if I did not sell and I stayed there for, like, you know, or if I stayed there for 4 years, I would have vested 4 years. I vested only 13 months, and then I kind of cashed out. So.
Okay. All right. So the happiest day, the day you get laid off, being laid off is, I only ever had that happen in a summer job, but like, what is that, the rest of that day? Like, you go home and now you don't have a job to get up and go to the next day, but you were happy that you weren't going to be at PayPal anymore because you felt like you didn't have a future there because that wasn't your path. Not because they didn't want you, like you said, because your path was somewhere else. So what was kind of the next feeling after this feeling of happiness? Did you feel like you needed to get up the next day and you knew exactly what you wanted to do? Or did you need some time to explore what you might be doing, of course, in a career sense?
I was already making decent chump change, like a chunk of change on the weekends doing birthday parties, because I was already doing that. So I remember there was one or two days I would call in sick from PayPal to work like a senior home or a corporate event. And it was like, oh, I'm making a lot more per hour just doing magic. And I was like, I could keep on doing this. I'm still living at home at this time. So it's just like, why rush? You know, Find out what you want to do. And at that time, I think I was making like $175 an hour or something like that or more. And I would
Working minimal hours, right?
Well, three shows on Saturday, maybe two on Sunday, and then doing some schools and libraries. So, you know, I do pretty good. You know, at PayPal, I think I was making $32,000 a year, and then plus stock options. And I think I was making close to comparable doing magic.
Was that like after you quit and were able to put more time into it, or at the same time as you were still at PayPal?
No, when I quit, and then I was a lot more happy too, because yeah. I didn't feel like imposter syndrome. I didn't feel like I belonged there. It just didn't feel right being there.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you had to be there though because of the pressure from your mom, or the pressure of you went and got a degree doing this, so you might as well work in it? Or what was the reason you even stayed as long as you did?
I got financial aid, and my mom kind of wanted me to go to college, so I just said yes to that. So I did that because of her.
Yeah, so that's why you went to college. But then at PayPal, why did you even stay 13 months if you were unhappy and wait until you got laid off? Why didn't you just quit if you were making decent money doing magic anyway?
I knew I had to save 1 year to vest. So I wanted to stay at least a year, that's for sure, because, you know, you heard about people cashing out. And my uncle would always talk about stock and stock options and stuff like this. So I knew stock options were worth something, or they could be. It was a gamble, but you would know that that there could be a big payoff at the end of the road. You know, there was a pot at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah. And for anyone who's not aware, basically what you're saying is, in addition to your salary, if you were there for a certain length of time, you would get issued stocks as part of your compensation, but you had to be there for set amounts of time to get set amounts of stock, right?
Yes. You need to be there at least a minimum of a year, because they're training you, they're doing a lot of stuff. So you need to complete a year, and then afterwards you'd vest monthly. For every month you were there, you'd theoretically would be contributing value. But the first 6 months, they're training you and putting money into you to be there. So why would they be, you know, allowing you to vest early?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the idea of staying for 12 months, getting those stocks, The advantage to that, of course, is, well, one, that's sort of part of your payment. But two, the thought process would be that a company like PayPal will eventually be so much bigger and worth so much more money that the stock you're getting now, if you just hold on to it, will be more valuable in the future. So it's absolutely worth staying long enough to get those stocks. Would that be right?
That's absolutely correct.
Perfect. Okay. But you end up leaving. Then after 13 months, you get laid off. You're doing magic part-time. I guess this allows you to contribute a lot more of your time to do magic. And it sounds like you didn't really have any intention of doing anything other than that. At this point, did you think that you could absolutely do this as a full-time career since you were doing so much of it even while you had a job at PayPal?
Like, full-time career is like a misnomer. I don't know how...
Well, this is career crossroads. So this is what we talk about. I got to try and figure out what was your thought process. What did you think you were going to be doing with the majority of your week and getting paid to do?
I just wanted the easy life. I don't know really what I wanted. I wanted to learn, and I always wanted to figure out how tricks work. And I wanted to get paid for that. I didn't care if I was going to be a magic consultant or performing magic or, you know, kids' birthday parties. They're on the low totem pole. But I had a mentor that said, don't poo-poo that. You know, like when he doesn't have anything, if he doesn't have anything on a date, in the early days, he would just do kids' birthday parties. So he kind of gave me that mentality saying like, you know, go do that. It's better to do that than street perform to me. Like, because you had a venue to perform at and you'd get paid a lot more. You'd be guaranteed an income.
So what was the progression then of you as a magician in your 20s, for example? So you're not working at a full-time job in finance. It doesn't really sound like you had a direction that you were trying to go in, or you were just, as you said, trying to have an easy life. So you didn't have really milestones you were setting about what you wanted to achieve as a magician at that time. So tell me what the progression was actually like when it comes to building your way up so that you could make that a viable career and start to make more money doing it, I guess. Because at the end of the day, careers are the ways we make our living. We make money to be able to do the things we want to do and support our families. So tell me about your progression in the early days.
Take any gig that paid and try to negotiate as much as I felt I was worth and get hired back for the next gig. Because I was just thinking, someone said to me, just do the math behind it. If you want to make $52,000 in a year, there's 52 weeks in a year, just make $1,000 a week. So if you're doing shows for 200, you need to do 200 times 5 to make 1,000 a week, or 250 times 4. So that's what's in my head is like, oh, if I want to make 100,000, I need to double that. So I need to either double my rates or double the amount that I'm working. So I was thinking, let me do both. Occasionally, sometimes people would not be able to pay me double, but there are certain times. So as things kind of flow, there's different seasons. Like in entertainment, I didn't realize there were certain months that are really slow. For example, Halloween is always busy and December is always busy. And then February is pretty busy because of Chinese New Year's, and Chinese organizations and groups would hire you. So in the beginning, it's just take the work. Don't be lazy. Like if they were offering me 50 less for what I thought I was worth, I'd still take the $50. I would be like, okay, that's not ideal. Sometimes they'd pay me like 50 or 100 more than I thought I was worth. And I remember getting $100 tips. I remember my first $20 tip, my first $100 tip, several $200 tips. And I was like, and then all the way up to $2,000 tips recently.
Mm-hmm. So all you were really doing is just working for the next show, one show at a time. You were just looking for what the next gig was. And how long did it stay like that? Or is that how it's kind of always been, where that's what you've really been trying to do as a magician?
You're always staying working, but you have to give yourself some time. Like right now, I'm in this crossroads as well in my career where I'm thinking if I want to do television, I should put more time in it. So I have opportunity to do a little bit of television coming up. But when you're going to your next step, sometimes you don't get paid for it. And you have to love that process and that work in order to get that. Like you're going to university, you don't get paid for that amount of time, but you have to love the process. Learn to love the process. For me, I love practicing, but now it's a different mindset. It's like you have to think, what is it the client wants? Whether I'm doing a trade show or whether I'm doing a corporate event. The majority of what I do now is corporate events, but during the pandemic, I did 52 shows in a week and 12 shows in a day over Zoom. I ended up doing well over 520 shows on my last pivot to Zoom. And right now we're going back to live in person. But one thing that I realize is I jump on calls all the time to show potential clients magic over Zoom. I have gotten so much buzz from people when they see my magic over Zoom as a demo that initially I would charge maybe $1,000, but I've been able to nail these $3,500 gigs just because I showed them a demo and you could hear the excitement.
So what's it been like over time having to pivot the way that you've promoted yourself from someone who's done primarily, initially you took whatever jobs, and I imagine now you're a little more selective about some of the work that you do. And I know you've mentioned you've changed the way that you brand yourself, the name that you have given yourself as a magician over time. So how has that evolved?
Yeah, I first started off doing magic and juggling and balloon sculpting. So my first business card I think I did was Dan Chan, the Balloon Man. Or even before that, it was like my friend's company's name. He was going by Generic Jugglers. He actually wrote that. I had a genericjugglers.tripod.com when that was a free domain thing. And then I went to Dan Chan Magic Man, to Dan Chan Master Magician, and then Dan Chan the Billionaire's Magician, and then Dan Chan the Millionaire's Mentalist, because I thought that was like people wouldn't call me if they thought that I was way too expensive and not affordable. So I found that rhymes and alliteration are hypnotic for selling. Dan Chan rhymes, Master Magician are alliterations, or a Millionaire's Mentalist. And I really thought that that was just kind of like so cool, because I had this competitor and friend. He said that his daughter was chanting my name all the way home for half an hour, because I made them shout that during my library show. And I think it was because I had a catchy jingle.
So obviously those names connotate the type of clients you've been working for over time. Balloon animals, more of, or jugglers, likely, I think a younger clientele on average. And then you said the billionaire magician at one point, and then millionaire. So obviously you are working for bigger clients, I guess, as time has gone on and as your brand has gotten bigger and more well-known.
Yep, that is correct. I've worked for a lot of very famous tech guys. Some I can talk about, some I can't. But many founders of companies like Twitter and Google and Yahoo, and it's just been a really cool roller coaster of a ride, and I'm loving every moment of it. Who says they can show up to a party? Or I mean, how many people can say they go to a party, they get fed for being there, they treat you like a celebrity often? I've been to parties where they had Bengal tigers in their backyard in a cage. You know, I've been to parties where they have flew in Mickey and his troupe for like 10K. I get to travel to places like Hawaii, New York, Chicago, Germany, Shanghai, and Las Vegas. It's just a dream job to me. I think it's a lot of fun.
I guess at this point, this is what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life. You're going to be a magician, and that is, you really did end up picking a career path, even if it wasn't fully all sort of on purpose and you knew what you wanted to do. You were doing something you were passionate about. It's become a career. You obviously have had a lot of success in it, and it's what you're going to be doing, I guess, long into the future as well, right?
Yeah, I might 10x it or 20x it. I might like charge 10 times the amount that I'm charging now, but I want to have a magic venue and find investors. I have a really cool business plan for having something like the Magic Castle in the Bay Area. If, for those of you who don't know what the Magic Castle is, it's a private exclusive club where you say open sesame to an owl and the bookshelf slides off to the side and it reveals a secret entrance. And you can see magicians of, you know, top caliber performing in a very formal setting. Like when I'm doing walk around at a party, I can only do so much. But if you give me a theatrical stage, you don't have to worry about losing people's attentions. So you can really tell stories and do other things. And it's not Vegas, it's just having your own venue that people will come to you, that you're so good that people will come to you. And I want to have a venue where other talents can shine like this. And I have a, if you're an investor or if you want to think about this, I'm also open to doing this for hotels or other places in the meantime, where I've partnered with restaurants to do a dinner show. If people have a private room, I've driven traffic to a lot of restaurants. And I provide the entertainment portion and then they provide the food. And I would love to do that in the future and combine the private club and the fine dining aspect.
Okay, so you've got some future plans. Seems like you really know what you want to do with the next stage of your career. It might not be the last stage of your career, but it's certainly the next stage of your career.
Yeah. I look at Richard Branson and I see he's done a lot of different things and he's known for different things like Virgin Atlantic, the cruise ships, all the other things. And I'm like, hey, if he can do it, I can do it too. I just need the right people, the right capital, the right team, and the people who believe in me, and also some unique competitive advantage, which I think is part hustle and part experience. There's a lot of things I know that I can transfer over that can make it, whether fine dining and magic, a really cool experience. How many people have seen really good food with good magic? It's a great pairing.
Yeah, not me. So hopefully you can get this off the ground. And then at some point when I'm down in California, I'll have to come check it out.
If you are ever in the Hollywood area or any of the listeners, hit me up. Mention that you heard about me through Jonathan's podcast, and I will see what I can do, depending on how much demand I have for the Magic Castle, because if that could be a full-time thing, sending out passes. But I have one VIP pass for you, Jonathan. Maybe I can work together. And then for everyone else, I have a lot of regular passes that I can probably hook you guys up with. It's a very exclusive club. Neil Patrick Harris, from Doogie Howser MD and How I Met Your Mother, was our president of Magic Castle. Jason Alexander of Seinfeld, George Costanza, has performed at the castle. And when he performed there, it was sold out. There are many other actors that have been magicians. And Johnny Carson used to love magic a lot, and he would have magicians all the time on his show as well. So again, if anyone wants to go to the Magic Castle, maybe we could work an arrangement out to get you in there and even talk about maybe if you'd like to invest or be a part of maybe a WeFunder or something like that.
Wonderful. So what is the best way for people to get in touch with you? Website, social media, tell me all that kind of stuff.
DanChanMagic.com and DanChanMagic on Instagram. I also have MillionairesMentalist.com for virtual shows. So if you are having a team building event or you're doing a birthday party isolated, a great thing to do would be to gather over Zoom. And I offer a free sample for 5 to 7 minutes to anyone who's considering booking me.
Okay, great. Well, I will put the links to all those things in the show notes so people can easily click on them. Just scroll down from wherever you're listening to this and you should find the links right then and there. Dan, thank you so much for sharing all this with me today. From a want to be a lifeguard to working at PayPal all the way to what you've been doing for a long time now as a full-time magician, it's been great hearing about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me.
Well, that is the career journey of Dan Chan, the Millionaire's Mentalist. I hope you enjoyed hearing about it. That's all for this week's episode of Career Crossroads. If you know someone who would benefit from hearing about Dan's career path, please share this episode with them. And if you want to hear more interviews like this, go to careercrossroads.ca or follow the podcast on your favorite podcast player.